Martino Royos has sung at all the great opera houses, Milan's La Scala, London's Covent Gardens, the Metropolitan Opera here in New York, during a sparkling career that spanned the 1950s through the 1980s. After she retired from the stage in 1989, she discovered a passion for teaching music, and over the past 7 years, she has been helping young opera singers get their starts through something else, the Martina Arroyo Foundation, which is based at Hunter College. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your foundation is dedicated to young opera singers just getting started in their careers. Was there anything like that when you became interested in pursuing a career as an opera singer?
Well, yes. Actually, it's how I got started, because the opera workshop of Hunter College, which was an evening session for young professionals back in the 50s, had a great program, and I attended the high school, and we used to imitate the singers as fresh young girls do, and I got caught and had to sing for the director, who, instead of punishing me, sent me to a voice teacher and started this career. But my interest in teaching was far earlier than the career, because I always thought that I wanted to be a teacher.
And
when Professor Turnau said, "Well, don't you want to be a singer?" I said, "Absolutely not. I want to be a school teacher." And all through the career, the working with young people, even though I didn't teach at the time, remained foremost in my mind.
Well, are people surprised when they hear Hunter College rather than Juilliard or Curtis in Philadelphia or one of the other famous music schools?
But that's because I hadn't planned to be a singer. As I said, I wanted to be.
But I mean, you're now back at Hunter. Obviously chose to go there rather than to go to Juilliard.
Well, no, absolutely, because I came from Hunter High School. Mm-hmm. Hunter High School is a very fine school. But
at that time, it was all girls, wasn't it?
So was the college. But we are not exactly at Hunter College all the time. We also work at the Liederkranz. Our program is held at the Liederkranz. Upper Manhattan, Upper East Side, and we take the performances into Hunter College K Playhouse, which we'll be doing this weekend. And in the middle of next week, we're doing two performances of Zauberflöte and two performances of Rita by Donizetti and Gianni Schicchi of Puccini. So,
I have spoken to a number of singers who've told me that they didn't consider the possibility of opera until their late teens, and usually even later than that,
yes,
when they're a lot older than that, partly because they weren't even aware of opera when they were growing up.
Many because they weren't aware, and others because the operatic voice doesn't develop in childhood. Mm-hmm. You might have a voice, but you can't sing opera. At least you shouldn't. Some people do start a little bit early, but I don't like that personally.
This is like going up on your toes when you're 6 years old, if you want to be a ballet dancer.
And sometimes at three. Mm-hmm. You know, violinists and pianists who study all their lives, we can't sing opera that too early.
Why? What does it just...
The vocal, your chords haven't developed, your body hasn't developed, you haven't found the center of your voice. With the boys, the voice hasn't yet changed.
So there you were being punished and being forced to learn how to sing.
Wonderful punishment.
And when did you realize that it might be opera rather than something else?
Once I started going to that opera workshop and really hearing it and watching other people work in their roles, and I don't know, it just took over.
But we're talking about the 40s and 50s. Other than Porgy and Bess, there weren't all that many opportunities for people of color to sing opera, were there?
But you know, when you go into something, you don't start out by saying, "What can my color do?" I think, "What can my talents do?" My
so
color
you didn't
is just
worry?
A part of it.
You didn't
no,
worry
I
that
didn't.
It would make it more difficult for you to break into the opera world?
Well, I think when you're trying to study something, you if you start off negatively, you'll never get there. Mm-hmm. You know, so especially since everybody knows I came from a very warm, open, loving family, and our motto was, "Go as far as you can and do as much as you can because you can."
So your parents saw this as a possibility rather than an unrealistic dream?
Not really. My father's idea of opera was a girl in a can-can outfit, you know, and he wasn't too keen about that. He said, well, if you're going to sing opera, then you'd better have another career so you can eat. But, of course, after he saw me eat, he thought maybe I should go back to can-can dancing. They didn't know that much about opera themselves and became addicted only when they came into my enthusiasm.
But you grew up here in New York City.
New Yorker.
And I wondered when you first visited the old great Metropolitan Opera House on Broadway and
39th Street. Yes. I was a child because at the time the Met used to let junior high school kids come in to see rehearsals, especially final rehearsals. And I think I saw 7 performances of Lohengrin, with Eleanor Stieber.
That's not a bad beginning.
Oh, not at all. On the contrary, I went into the field, didn't I? But that isn't what started it. It was really the opera workshop.
But that was a beautiful place with great acoustics. Unfortunately, had problems being a little cramped. I remember walking down the street and seeing all these flats out on the street because there was no room for them inside the building.
But what a history, the singers that sang there.
But it was also a different time. Opera, yes. You would see opera singers on the Ed Sullivan Show. I remember the tryouts for the Metropolitan Opera were broadcast on the radio.
That's how I started in 58. In 58, we went to the ABC studio and sang with the orchestra. If you made the finals, we weren't on stage from the beginning, and you weren't given an automatic contract. Some of us were given small contracts. Others went to Europe, and Mr. Bing advised me eventually to go to Europe too, but not because he didn't want to present me in a role that was non-white. It was because he felt I needed the experience, and as soon as he heard that I had gotten it and there was the opportunity, he called me back.
Well, it was a different kind of American Idol in those days, but where did you go in Europe?
Oh, all over Germany, Yugoslavia, Scandinavia, singing not opera all the time, but lots of recitals, lots of oratorios, and that's a part of my life that people don't know. There was much more involvement in concert work than for a 22-year-old singing Aida, which was the first opera I was asked to sing, and then Butterfly. Those are very big operas.
Well, you're starting with two of the greatest composers of operas.
How about that? And Mozart.
Verdi and Puccini and Mozart. Yeah. That's pretty good. Are there certain composers whose work you particularly enjoy singing?
The three you just mentioned.
And favorite roles?
Oh, now this is a question that's difficult because I always find that the role that I'm singing at the moment is the role I love the most because I love playing that woman.
Although some people say it's the one that shows off my voice best.
I don't sing a role if it doesn't show my voice at its best. There are roles that I would have liked to have sung but didn't because my voice wasn't right for it.
What about recording? You've done a fair amount of recording, but I'm assuming there were some things that you wished you could have had recorded.
Oh, yes, of course. Of course. We just listened recently to Simone Boccanegra from the Chicago Opera, and I really thought about the beauty of Cappuccilli singing the Simone and Cossutta, Carlo Cossutta singing Gabriele and Ruggero Raimondi. I wish that had been recorded officially. They're only out on pirate recording, unfortunately.
I've spoken to jazz musicians who said, gee, if there only had been some recording equipment on that night where Ben Webster came in and joined us or something like that. There had to have been thrilling nights where you just wish that somebody had had recording equipment and there could even be a pirate.
And in fact, not only at the theater, but we have a big gala. One is coming up in November for our Prelude to Performance. And Paquito de Rivera comes to it. And he brought his instruments and a couple of young men. And they played in all of these opera lovers who were sitting in their seats dancing. And at the end of the gala said, is he coming back next year? So,
my guess is Martina Arroyo, who sang with all the great opera companies into 1989 when you retired.
Well, I sang a little bit after that. I think the last was Flying Dutchman, but in the 90s I sang recitals and and still went around, but I didn't consider myself, I didn't consider it my career at that time. I had gone into teaching.
Had it just become too difficult or too much of a strain on your voice,
no,
or you just became more interested in teaching?
I adored singing. And I did enjoy teaching, which, of course, you see, is what I wanted to do all along. But I found myself getting up in my own home and not remembering where the bathroom was because I had traveled so much that I'd lost home, and I just wanted home back.
There's that other side. You knew what you were going to be doing 3 years in the future.
4 years sometimes. You know, if you know that you're on April 1st, you have a rehearsal at 10, that doesn't leave much time for you to think of your own life. But the idea of our program is not so much to work with singers as singers, but to work with them as the acting part of it, the living the character. Mm. And I thought that we don't get enough of that training, and so our program concentrates on that.
Well, you began teaching in 1989 or so, but there was a big gap between that and the creation of the foundation.
Well, the foundation was created a few years later, but we started out with just a roll class. Then we thought, well, let's have a summer program where there'll be 6 weeks working with other people as well as with me. So now we have 21 teachers, and they study from 10 in the morning until 6, all kinds of courses, you know, coaching, speaking the roles, learning the language, combat, staging of the operas that have been chosen. Then we did that with good costumes so that they could look the parts. And then we said, well, they really need an orchestra. So we got an orchestra. And it became a big production, but the basis is still to study the character.
And you say the acting. That's something that you probably didn't get much training in when
you
began.
Not as much as I could have used.
So you just had to learn on the fly?
I learned it with great directors like Lotfi Mansouri, like Tito Capobianco, like Franco Enriquez. John Dexter taught me many things about the stage. But I was learning it little by little as I went along. It was the voice carrying me. But I think today you're expected to come out and be that character, to be that, live in that skin right on. And even if you're standing next to the greatest singer in the world, you have to bring up your part to make it equal or as equal as possible.
I've always wondered about how opera singers sing not only to be heard at the very last row, but also over a full orchestra that's in front of them. That's incredible projection sometimes.
Well, you learn how to sing and to project, but you don't worry about that in the performance. By that time, you should be aware of what you can do. I think there you worry about who you are, how you relate to your colleagues, to give the audience a complete picture, a complete show.
Now, in these performances that you're about to present,
yes,
the Magic Flute, Mozart,
yes,
forgive me for not saying it in German.
Oh, that's all right.
Donizetti's Rita, Gianni Schicchi by Puccini.
Yes.
Are these particularly suitable for young voices?
I think so. The Puccini, of course, is always a little bit of a stretch, mainly because the orchestra. But we know that we're a program, and we know that we can ask but so much of them vocally, and we don't go past that. They're not supposed to sound like Flagstadt. They're to use their voices. But the point is, are they developing that character within their vocal abilities? And Zauberflöte is a much harder opera than one thinks, you know. But for young people, it's a great learning tool. There's recitative, there's dialogue, those tools that one needs to be in the profession. Rita is wonderful. It's Donizetti, and it's light and about. It's a woman who abuses her husband, so I thought that was rather timely.
Both Italian operas are comic operas.
Yes, they are. And the point, again, being light enough for a young person to be involved and not hurt them vocally.
And you are also having them sung in the original languages.
Absolutely. The dialogue is also in the original language.
Now, what do you think about this trend to translate operas into English?
I can understand why recitative is translated into English. I don't like the change back and forth because I think that very often what we see is the character in German singing with the German character, and then they go into English and they sound American again. You know, they behave American again. Especially since we have surtitles. I mean, I'd love to hear the operas in the original.
Well, when actors go and act in a foreign language, they often need a little dubbing to help them get through because their accents are far from perfect. Does it matter when you sing?
We have to learn the language. Learning the language is, for me, as important as taking those voice lessons.
So you actually learned German, you learned Italian, learned French.
I wouldn't say that anyone is going to mistake me for a French woman. My husband certainly thinks my French stinks, but he's a Frenchman and very, very peculiar. But the singing and the speaking, and also because you take directions in a French house in French usually, in an Italian house in Italian. So it's to your advantage to know the language and also to know the nuance, the idioms, so that you can express them properly.
Now, you sit on the board of directors at Carnegie Hall, at the Metropolitan Opera Guild, and some other organizations.
Collegiate
and right
Chorale.
Now, and we're hearing these days about serious problems in getting funding.
Yes.
How serious is it?
Very serious. Very serious, especially for a young program, because somehow Carnegie Hall and the Metropolitan Opera, and rightly so, will have larger sums of money behind them from larger corporations, from larger donors. We work with the least part of it. You know, if we get $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, that's considered a good donation. But our budget is over $300,000, because to have an orchestra nowadays, you're talking about $35,000. And we want it because we want them to have the most professional experience they can have. And we want them to, for it to be class, to be a good, a very decent person, not more than decent. I want it to be first class.
We don't have much time, but I wanted to ask you about appearing on Johnny Carson's show.
Oh, I loved it.
You're not going to see that anymore. I can't imagine an equivalent singer, somebody really good, being invited on Jay Leno's or one of those
shows. I think Marilyn Horne has been on Letterman, hasn't she? And she's great on these shows. I mean, we used to do Odd Couples and things like that. And people know us from these shows. People have come up in airports and have talked about those shows years later.
Martina Arroyo Foundation's Prelude to a Performance is presenting Donizetti's Rita and Puccini's Gianni Schicchi July 11th and July 14th, and then Mozart's Die Zauberflöte July 10th and the 13th at K Playhouse at Hunter College. You can find more information on our show page at wnyc.org. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
It's my pleasure, and I hope you'll come. You'll be so welcomed.